Hello, and welcome to House of Comments podcast. My name is Nick Dennis, and I'm a conservative blogger. This week, I'm going to be talking to Rafif Jojati, a spokesperson for the Syrian Opposition Coalition at the Geneva Peace Talks, and I'll be talking to her about those talks and what she hopes for Syria. Also, I'm going to be speaking to James Dellingpool, the new executive editor of Breitbart London, a new blog that's been launched in the UK this week. And finally, I'm going to speak to Peter Franklin, who edits The Deep End at Con Home and writes regularly for The Times, on why Conservatives should stop boasting about how much income tax the rich pay. The conflict in Syria is still continuing. By August last year, it was estimated that more than 100,000 people had been killed since the start of the conflict. Millions more Syrians have been displaced from their homes. The different sides have recently been holding peace talks in Geneva. I talk to Rafif Jojati, a spokesperson for the Syrian Opposition Coalition. I started off by asking her what it was like to be part of a country that descended into civil war.
I take issue with the term civil war. We in the opposition continue to say that it's not a civil war, but rather a popular uprising that is being crushed by military force by the government. The reason we don't call it a civil war is because the revolution began peacefully, and for 7 or 8 months into the revolution, nobody took up arms except the regime. And when people took up arms, it was in self-defense. And with the influx of foreign fighters, and we believe that this is driven by the Assad agenda, these are people who are actually fighting for Assad's interests. So we don't call it a civil war, and we maintain that this is a popular uprising. Now, what is it like to be part of a revolution?
Yes.
It is, at the beginning, it was absolutely exhilarating because as a Syrian, for the first time in my lifetime, people were saying no to dictatorship and no to corruption. And they were calling for freedom and dignity and democracy, and that those young people across Syria had the courage to go out in massive demonstrations was just amazing. But as the death toll started to rise, it became devastating because for those of us who don't live in Syria, all we can do is support and watch. And we have watched the regime grow increasingly violent, increasingly, I would say, insane in the way it is responding to this popular uprising.
Okay, so for those of us who don't know the details, I suppose there's two questions that come out of that. Firstly, the impression we get of the foreign fighters aren't that they're sort of helping the Assad regime, but they're more, shall we say, Islamic extremists or Al-Qaeda-type-back people who've come in and seen an opportunity to maybe create their own type of state. So it's almost like a freeway war, sort of uprising. Is that a correct perception?
No, it's an incorrect perception. For Western listeners, as soon as you say Islamic extremists or Al-Qaeda, that appears to be a catch-all term. And then one immediately thinks, well, at least Assad is secular, and so better the devil we know. And that's absolutely incorrect. We in the opposition feel very strongly and are collecting evidence that says that Assad is collaborating directly with ISIS, with those foreign fighters and some Syrian Islamic extremists who wish to set up a Sharia state in Syria. And this tactic can only be useful for so long. And what Assad is trying to do is say, it is me or these extremists, this is the alternative. And in fact, he is propping them up and collaborating with them. As a Syrian and as a member of the opposition, I don't want to be put into one of those two camps. I am neither an Assad supporter, nor am I an Islamic State supporter. I speak for civil society. I speak for women's involvement. I speak for a popular uprising. I speak for a revolution for freedom and democracy. So I think one of the things we have to do is help inform Western audiences that this is not a struggle between Islamists and Assad. This is a struggle between the people of Syria and the Assad regime.
Okay, so moving on to the recent talks that happened in Geneva, was it worth it?
I think it was worth it in the sense that for the first time, the opposition was able to squarely face the regime's representatives and say, we are here, you have to recognize us, we are a legitimate entity, we are an alternative to the dictatorship, and the people of Syria are ready to transition from dictatorship to democracy. So we forced the regime to hear us. It was also worth it in the sense that I think a lot of the regime's atrocities were exposed internationally. And there was no question that the regime, the Assad delegation's behavior at the Geneva talks was completely belligerent and combative, unprofessional, and lacked any sort of seriousness. And so for even casual observers, they saw that the opposition coalition was there very committed to pursuing a political process, and the regime was stalling at every step of the way.
I mean, do you think there can be progress through these talks? Because at the moment it seems like they're very, very strong-minded people, certainly on all sides.
Well, I think the Assad regime is intransigent, and I certainly don't believe that Bashar al-Assad is going to negotiate himself out of a job. He and his family have treated Syria like their personal backyard. But the benefit of pursuing a political process is that the opposition can strengthen, can more closely unify its ranks, can become an even more cohesive group, and can work with international partners to pressure Assad.
What can the West do? Because we obviously see on the news the horrific stuff that's happening in Syria, and every time you see that, you feel like you want to do something because you don't, you know, these are fellow human beings dying in atrocious ways. But at the same time, there seems to be reluctance among many Western governments to get involved. So what do you think the West can do to help?
Well, at the individual level, concerned citizens of the world, because we are all human, concerned citizens need to pressure their governments, and so they need to write to their representatives, they need to call their representatives, they need to stage demonstrations and create petitions and forward them to their government representatives. At the policy level, analysts need to take a look at the humanitarian situation, at the political situation, and recognize that the atrocities that are being committed are of genocidal proportion. And we cannot allow a world in which a dictator drops barrel bombs on civilian neighborhoods or uses chemical weapons with impunity, can drag out the process of dismantling and destroying chemical weapons. So the policy analysts and the policy makers need to be looking at those questions.
So does that mean, do you think that countries like the United Kingdom and the USA should intervene militarily or supply arms to those people who are fighting for a democratic society?
Well, the opposition coalition has consistently called for weapons to the Free Syrian Army, and it's important to note that the Free Syrian Army is a largely secular body that emerged as a result of people's need for self-defense. The coalition has asked for a no-fly zone. They have asked for weapons to shift the balance of power on the ground, and I believe the coalition has remained consistent in that. Now, as Western nations have said that military involvement is pretty much off the table, we are pursuing a political solution. So again, if the West is not going to arm those who would liberate Syria from this dictatorship, then we pursue a political process with full commitment, but we expect our international partners now to pressure the Assad regime.
One of the reasons that's used by those who don't want to supply arms to people like the Free Syrian Army is that it's difficult to realise who is with which force, and the second one is that the weapons might fall into what people describe as the wrong hands, whatever that is. I mean, are those two risks real?
I really don't think so. Weapons are already in the wrong hands. The regime used chemical weapons. I would say those are the wrong hands. The regime controls the skies and drops barrel bombs on civilian neighborhoods. In fact, there were another 19 barrel bombs just this morning on Daraya, a suburb of Damascus. Those are weapons in the wrong hands. The Western powers know very well the structure and makeup of the Free Syrian Army. The battalions within the Free Syrian Army have been uniting and have declared an open war on ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So we know who the right hands are. The Free Syrian Army has also pledged and made commitments that post-Assad there would be a transition to a civilian-led government. So I think the opposition has provided the kinds of assurances needed to justify military involvement. And by the same token, the kinds of weapons that are used in modern warfare today are easily tracked, so that I think any Western power that would supply the weapons would be able to know in which hands the weapons were going.
Is there anything else we can do from a humanitarian perspective? For instance, at the moment we're having a debate in this country about how many Syrian refugees we should let in, and obviously we are, you know, the UK is giving aid to help in the camps that are setting up in Turkey, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you think we should be doing from a humanitarian perspective?
Well, I think in the West we should also be looking at students who wish to finish their educations but obviously can't do that in Syria, and so we need to be looking at scholarships. Those students are among those who will rebuild the country. I think committed citizens should look at the different types of organizations that are providing relief to Syrians. And one example is the Foundation to Restore Equality in Education in Syria. And those types of organizations, in general, have either little or no overhead expenses and have a purely humanitarian mission. So I think citizens can get involved in some of the ongoing projects. Many of our projects are limited in scope but have a huge impact on families. And I think we have to look at internally at our own humanity. If we can save a life or the life of a family, are we not better off for having done that? And it costs so little.
So what are your hopes for the future? I mean, obviously, it seems like a strange question to ask right now, but obviously, through being the organisations you're a member of and senior in, you obviously do have hope for the future.
I have hope for the future because every time I talk to activists inside the country, they have hope. And when I know that the majority of Syrians have refused to take up weapons and they continue with a peaceful mission, that gives me hope. So my hope is that we can get through this political process, that we can transition to democracy, that Syrians of all backgrounds and ages and political beliefs can go back and rebuild their country and turn it into the nation that the original protests were dreaming of.
And what was that nation?
And that nation was a nation bound by the rule of law, a nation in which all citizens are equal, regardless of their social or economic or religious beliefs or status. A Syria in which all citizens have the right to personal dignity, a Syria in which freedom and democracy prevail.
Thank you, Refif. I hope from the bottom of my heart that the conflict in Syria ends and people can get on with their lives. This week, the successful US right-wing website, Breitbart, launched a London blog. I spoke to London's executive editor, James Dellingpole, about why Breitbart is needed in the UK.
For those who don't know what this new website's about, can you explain how it started and why it was so successful in the US?
Yeah, Andrew Breitbart is kind of a legend in internet circles in that he was responsible for helping Arianna Huffington set up the HuffPost in the days when Arianna Huffington was still on the right before she decided that there was more traffic in going left with consequences we rue today. He also founded a site called Breitbart.com. And Andrew Breitbart was a lively, outspoken, no prisoners conservative. He was funny. He loved taking the fight to the left. He loved... The left has Saul Alinsky, all these Alinskyite methods. I think what Andrew believed, and as I believe, is that there is no reason why being a conservative should be about being fuddy-duddy and being always on the defensive against the left's tactics. And I think that is the Breitbart has that fighting spirit, despite the fact that poor old Andrew keeled over of a heart attack a couple of years ago.
So what do you reckon the London-based arm of this blog will bring to the UK blogosphere?
Well, I hope it will be feisty, funny. I hope it will be quick with the stories, because above all, Breitbart is a news site rather than the comment site. It's a news website for those of a conservative persuasion, and the kind of conservatism that it represents, I would say, is on the libertarian stroke Tea Party stroke classical liberal side rather than the fuddy-duddy social conservative side.
So not necessarily supporting the Conservative Party, even though it's a conservative blog.
No, I think one could define it as the antithesis of, say, the Conservative Home or of the Times comment pages, the kind of Tim Montgomery sort of Cameroonish loyalist element in the Tory Party. This is much more for the people who have quit the Tory Party in disgust and joined UKIP, and for those people in still in the Conservative Party who have faith in people like Owen Paterson and Douglas Tarswell and Steve Baker and Rees-Mogg, people like that, proper conservatives.
At the launch, the chief executive of the international site said, "We look at London and Texas as two fronts in our current cultural and political war." What does that really mean? Because I don't feel like we're in a cultural and political war here.
Well, you've got to think about it from the perspective of an American. They look across at Europe and they see us as being very much on the front line in the war on Islamism, for example. They see us as being more politically correct than in America. I mean, I think in many ways America is at least as politically correct as we are. But I think they look across at Europe, they see a bunch of Euro weenies enslaved by the EU-SSR, and they fear, not unreasonably, I think, that this is the way they are headed in Obama's America. So they see us as the bellwether of the horrors to come.
Is that how you see it? I mean, do you think we're enslaved by the EU-SSR?
The whole thing that motivates me is that I believe that we are fighting the culture wars, and the culture wars are essentially the battle against entrenched cultural Marxism. And this war has many fronts, feminism, environmentalism, Islamism, political correctness, the relentless drive by the left for bigger government. This is all great fun to write about, not just because the enemy is so rapacious and evil, but also because I think there's lots of people out there who read our stuff and go, "Hey, I'm not alone. Somebody else feels this way."
What you're talking about is basically stopping the state from stopping individuals from being individuals, I suppose, by categorizing them into different categories. Is that what you're saying? Basically, there's too much do-goodery, shall we say, trying to promote feminism and equality legislation and all that sort of stuff.
Nick, I think what's happened is that we think we're free in this country. We think we're not like the Soviet Union or Mao's China, and of course, in many degrees, that's absolutely true. But I think that we live in a soft tyranny, a progressive tyranny, and I'm not, although I think a lot of people feel it in the course of their daily lives, they grumble about how they can't speak as freely as they used to. George MacDonald Fraser wrote an excellent essay on this once. I commend it to your listeners. Google George MacDonald Fraser, you know, the author of the Flashman series, who said that his wartime generation had much greater freedom of speech than our modern politically correct culture does. And I think that little by little, we are having our freedoms stripped away from us. And what I hope to be able to do at Breitbart London, and my colleagues hope to do, is to be able to draw attention to the way our freedoms are being eroded, and to speak up for smaller government and all the things that I think that the modern Conservative Party should be standing for. Isn't.
But surely we do have free speech. There's massive degrees of difference between us and a Maoist state. For a start, we have a democracy. Is it not true that most people consistently choose what you say is a bad situation?
Well, I don't want to sound too much like a Marxist here, but I suppose that perhaps these people in the middle ground are guilty of are prey to false consciousness. I think because this stuff has crept up on us over the years, the left has been very clever. The Gramsciite left, the long march through the institutions, the way that, for example, the BBC has been captured, the seats of academe have been captured, most of our schools have been captured by the kind of Guardian mentality, Guardian stroke BBC mentality, that I think a lot of people don't really have the intellectual tools to articulate or even understand what's going on. And that's one of the functions that we at Breitbart, I think, will perform. We'll draw attention to what has been happening. I don't want to sound like a paranoid conspiracy theorist. I mean, of course, this is not Kim Jong-un's North Korea. This is not Pol Pot's Cambodia. This is not Mao's China. Nevertheless, I think that we have much work to be done in reducing the size of government, and I think it's a crusade worth fighting.
Is the situation really as bad as you say? The masses who are not as interested in politics as us can watch Strictly Come Dancing, while you can run a website which allows you to say what you want.
The war on freedom of speech is much more subtle than that. I mean, already we have legislation introduced under Tony Blair, which makes certain kinds of joke illegal, doesn't it? There are laws on hate speech of various kind. I would draw your attention to Milton's Areopagitica, in which he argues that in a free society, it is necessary that we hear bad people's bad points of view and wrong opinions and offensive language, in order to expose them to, for them to be judged in their wrongness. I think censorship in any form is wrong, and I think that at the moment we live in a time where there are subtle forms of censorship, and it's fascinating to me that you think that these things don't exist. I see it all the time in places, unlikely places like Twitter. There is a kind of bullying culture whereby various leftist, what I call cultural Marxist subsections, will try and make certain things unsayable. I don't think they should be.
I mean, I'm sort of slightly shocked by your complacency.
I'm not saying that everything is perfect, but I don't think most people believe that the problem is as bad as you say. If you're chatting to someone in the pub who was not really interested in politics, how would you convince them that their complacency was wrong?
It's interesting that you mention Strictly Come Dancing, that we are free to watch programmes like, the masses are free to watch programmes like Strictly Come Dancing. But this is exactly it. It's kind of pabulum for the herd, isn't it? It's It's Breton circuses. As long as people have got their white goods and their cheap Ryanair flights, and their Saturday night entertainment, they needn't worry about anything else. So I agree that it's going to be quite difficult penetrating into their brainwashed minds. But the idea that we have this freedom of speech, I think it's illusory. Let me give you one extraordinary recent example. The leader of the Green Party, Natalie Bennett, recently demanded on the BBC that climate change skeptics or deniers, as she called them, in the cabinet should be sacked for their beliefs. Now, I would have thought that a statement like that ought to have ensured that the Green Party was on the front pages of all the newspapers with demands that they be cast into hell, ignored in perpetuity for their stupidity and wrongness. But we live in a culture, unfortunately, where actually quite a lot of this goes on. I mean, environmentalism is a field that I've been spending a lot of time battling in the last 5 years, and I encounter this a lot. That you look at the way that climate change skeptics are treated on the BBC, our state broadcaster, and they are treated as sort of comedy clown figures who are there basically on sufferance. And another place I encounter this kind of attitude is Twitter, where there's an awful lot of you get shot down for saying anything about anything that smacks of skepticism about climate. You get shot down that smacks of anything that might be anti-feminist. And I am an anti-feminist, by the way. I can't stand feminists. I love women, and I'm not a misogynist. But I think that the feminist movement is vile, and I think that one of the ways our culture operates is let me give you that example. The way that feminists are able to get away with conflating anti-feminism, or simply being a man, with misogyny, and I think the two are not the same at all. So I think that although we are notionally free in our speech, actually, when you scratch beneath the surface, you realize that many of our freedoms have been taken away subtly, either by laws introduced under Tony Blair directly or indirectly by a culture of political correctness.
And thank you to James. We look forward to seeing how the blog goes. And finally, this week I spoke to Peter Franklin, who edits the Deep End section of Conservative Home and also is a regular columnist for The Times. We discussed the traps which some of the right wing can fall into when discussing tax, welfare and state intervention.
Okay, Peter, in the article you wrote for the Deep End blog, right wingers should stop boasting about how much income tax the rich pay. You started by saying the richest 1% of Britons contribute 30% of all the income tax collected in this country. This supposedly is a killer fact deployed with devastating complacency by the free market right. Why did you write that?
Well, because I kept on hearing this trotted out over, you know, recent years, and it's not always 30%. The precise percentage seems to vary over time, but it's always, you know, here's a great big chunk which is, you know, a multiple of the percentage of people who fall into that bracket, the 1%. Doesn't this show that actually we've got nothing to worry about, and we should thank the rich for effectively paying our tax for us? I just thought that this was a ridiculous argument, because income tax obviously reflects income. So all that so-called killer stat actually reflects is that the richest 1% are taking a massive share of the country's income.
Why do you think those who want to lower the top rate of tax use this then as an example to support their argument?
Well, I mean, it does go back to 60s and 70s, when we had genuinely confiscatory rates of income tax. And those were lowered, most famously by Nigel Lawson, when he took it from 60% to 40% in one fell swoop. And back then, there was a case for saying that actually, you know, the rich are paying more now, because we're seeing a lot of the funds that were pushed offshore to escape what was effectively confiscation by the British states were coming back, and were actually making a useful contribution. So that was a perfectly good argument. But now it's being applied to actually what are relatively minor variations in the top rates of tax. And it's totally missing the fact that actually the percentage of the country's income that's going to the richest people has been growing for some while now, and that sort of middling incomes are stagnating. And that's a real problem that Conservatives should be worrying about. And so the right-wingers who trot out the so-called killer fact are actually missing what is the key issue, and I think it's a dreadful mistake.
So in terms of the key issue, what do you think a Conservative solution to the problem that you've just talked to us about is? Because obviously Conservatives, well, the modern strand of Conservatism, is very wary about state intervention and rebalancing the economy.
Well, except that state intervention has actually helped to boost the incomes of the rich. You know, most spectacularly and scandalously in the case of the bank bailouts. But there's all sorts of other ways in which the rich are doing very well out of what some people call the welfare state. And examples of that include paying over the odds on all sorts of government contracts. It relates to the very large bonuses increases in remuneration that public sector managers have been getting. I mean, we saw with the BBC and the payoff culture there. So whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, those right at the top of the income scale are doing very well out of government decisions. And actually, the one I should really mention, of course, is QE, quantitative easing, which has had the effect of boosting the asset values of certain asset classes, which are held by, overwhelmingly held by the wealthy. So all of these artificial interventions are doing the bank balances, the portfolios of the rich, a lot of favours. And perhaps government should start thinking a little bit more carefully about the people in the middle, especially, who aren't seeing the benefit of this and have actually seen their income stagnate.
So what should a Conservative government do? What should Conservatives campaign for then?
Golly. it is a fundamental issue. It touches upon issues of globalisation, of automation, new technology. All of these things are, the fundamental drivers of economic change. For a start, government really needs to understand what's going on. And I'm not sure there's a huge amount of research being done into this and into the underlying causes. So until you do that, It's very hard to come up with a comprehensive policy program, but there are, you know, there are things in the meantime that could be done.
Well, I mean, for a start, off the top of my head, I mean, a bit more honesty in messaging, maybe. So obviously, a lot of the hardworking families talk doesn't really reflect the reality of the situation, does it? Really, so.
Is that
a fair comment? That just came into my mind while you were talking, but start the rhetoric. So just start being a bit more honest about the situation. Well, honest about the situation might help.
I must say that I find the hard work aspect problematic. Most people, you know, yes, there's a minority of the population that live to work, but most people work to live. You know, they're not in sort of fantastically interesting jobs. They're in jobs to earn an honest day's wage for their family. So all of this sort of hard work rhetoric is a bit ridiculous and out of touch. Clearly, to maximise people's earnings potential, we need to make sure that we've got education policies that equip people with the most marketable skills. We might need to think about whether we really should send quite so many people on purely academic courses, and in fact redirect a lot of that effort towards vocational education.
I mean, would you previously you mentioned sort of maybe, you know, some of the issues such as quantitative easing. I mean, would you favour a sort of sharper shock maybe in monetary policy, or I mean, do you think this is a long term solution that is quite difficult to sort of fit into the political rhetoric that we're seeing now coming up to 2015?
Well, I mean, QE has been there to serve another purpose, which was to help recapitalise bank balance sheets and so on. But, you know, once, you know, the banking system looks fully stabilised and hopefully we're out of the woods on that, the banks need to start paying back, to be honest. I think there needs to be certainly when it comes to the disposal of the very large shareholdings that the government has in semi-nationalised banks like RBS, we've got to make sure that, you know, ordinary working people get their fair share from that, because effectively it was their taxes that bailed them out. You know, when I think it was Warren Buffett who was involved in shoring up some of the tottering financial institutions at the time with his own private funds. You know, he didn't do that as an act of charity. He did it because, you know, he was going to make some money on the deal, on the risk that he took and the service he provided to the institutions that he helped bail out. Government needs to be as hard-nosed on our behalf as these investors are on their own behalf.
What do you think stops them from being so?
I don't know. I think there's still a bit of a... I think ministers, the elites, still quite haven't got their heads around the fact that the taxpayer did rescue the entire banking system. Most of it would have collapsed. And it was such a special circumstance that I wonder if those in charge have really understood that actually those rescued institutions owe us big time, and they should pay a very hefty price for the service that was provided to them.
Okay, I'm going to I'm going to pretend to be Aladdin's lamp, basically you're allowed to put three things into the Conservative manifesto for 2015. What would you put in?
Oh gosh, well,
you've got to be prepared for these type of questions.
Yes,
you don't know when Aladdin's lamp's going to turn up.
I think the first thing I'd like, actually, I'd like a series of things on the property market. I would like, first of all, I'd like planning authorities, local authorities, to have the right to specify that new build housing only goes to owner-occupiers and even, in some cases, just to first-time buyers. So, yeah, so I'd like, you know, sort of a big proportion of new housing actually excluding the sort of buy-to-let market and it actually going to ordinary people rather than the rentier class. So that's one. I think the second thing I'd like to see is a bit of a rebalancing of the tax system. So it is more transparent in the rates that different income brackets are charged. So what I'm thinking of there is, yes, you've got income tax, which looks pretty progressive, but actually once you've factor in national insurance, the rates are a lot flatter than they appear. So I'd like kind of a combined rate showing that sort of making very clear exactly what proportion of income different income brackets actually pay. And then the third thing, well, I think I'd like to see the assets of RBS, Lloyds, etc. I'd like to see at least a proportion of those handed directly to taxpayers in the form of free shares.
Thank you for joining me this week for what I think has been a really interesting show. Next week we have a special show because it's the 100th edition of House of Commons podcast, and I hear there might be some special guests appearing with me and Mark and Emma. So before I go, I'd just like to thank Kevin MacLeod for the music, and also Audioboo for hosting this podcast, and of course everyone for listening.